Dr. Jacques Vallée is an almost mythical figure among those interested in UFOs.
Who are you people?
Monsieur Néré, please, one more question. N'avez-vous pas fait récemment une rencontre?
Have you recently had a close encounter?
Une rencontre plutôt inhabituelle?
A close encounter with something very unusual.
Who are you people?
And while he wasn't really in that movie, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, there's no doubt that the French UFO researcher you just heard was based on the real life Jacques Vallée. And as it turns out, Vallée was right smack in the middle of not just UFOs, but a lot of the most important frontier science that has shaped our evolving understanding of who we are. Take, for example, telepathy, mind reading, now falling under the category of parapsychology. But go back 50 years to Stanford Research Institute, when Hal Puthoff and Russell Targ, who go on to run the U.S. military psychic spying program, are investigating this Israeli psychic named Uri Geller.
Discussing, we were at the SRI cafeteria, you know, having lunch. And a big round table, and Geller was across the table from me. And Geller suddenly says, I want to do an experiment with you, Jacques. So I'm going to send you...
Now, this is a great story, and you'll hear the whole thing in this interview, but let me cut to the chase. So Geller instructs Vallée how to do this little experiment, and it works. So they take the next step. They're right there in the SRI cafe, which kind of blows me away. I mean, they're sitting down having lunch, and they go, well, what the heck? We have some envelopes left over from the experiment we were just running. Let's use one of those, see what happens.
I thought, I'm going to send it in two things. I'm going to send the whale, which is essentially a fish. I know a whale isn't a fish, but, you know, I'm going to send a fish, and I'm going to send the water jet that I see through the window. Geller said, all of a sudden, he was all business. He took his pencil, and he drew something, and he says, look, I'm going to draw what I'm getting. But I'm not getting one thing, I'm getting two things. I'm getting a fish, and then I'm getting a water jet. So he drew the two things. He didn't draw the target. There was no way he could have known that I did not send him the target. I sent him two things that I made up. And that's what he got.
Now, it's almost hard to believe that all this happened exactly the way he's saying. I mean, this is Jacques Vallée and everything, but come on. Well, here's the real kicker. He wrote it all down in his journal. So here's a guy who's right in the middle of the computer revolution in Silicon Valley, a world-class computer scientist at the time. And he's right in the middle of the parapsychology thing and right in the middle of the UFO thing. And he wrote it all down. And that's what we're going to talk about here on Skeptico. Now, this interview covers a lot of ground in the 1 hour we have, and I did have a chance to ask Dr. Vallée directly about the UFO consciousness link that we were talking about in the last episode of Skeptico, and I thought his answer was quite interesting. When I hear people use your work as a manifesto against little gray men in spaceships from other planets, I don't know how you get around that data.
You have to get out of these little boxes, you know, physics on my left and psychology on my right. You can't do that. But you cannot do that in dealing with UFOs. But what I'm saying is that you cannot do that anymore in dealing with astrophysics. The problem that scientists have today is that time and space, the way we were thinking about them, don't make sense when you begin to deal with particle entanglement and with entanglement of larger, of larger physical things. So we're going to get to the same place eventually.
Well, there you go. For me, someone interested in using science to find deep spirituality, everyone getting to the same place sounds just about perfect. Stay tuned. This is a good one. My interview with Dr. Jacques Vallée is next on Skeptico.
Today we welcome Dr. Jacques Vallée to Skeptico. Now, if you know anything at all about UFO research, or even if what you know is limited to what you've seen in Steven Spielberg movies about UFO research, you probably know about the amazing career of Dr. Jacques Vallée. But I promise you, whatever you think you know, it's only the beginning, because Dr. Vallée has just re-released 3 volumes of his journals, diaries, notes, musings. The books are titled Forbidden Science, Volume 1, 2, 3. They span more than 30 years of his career and his life. They're very personal at times. It's all there. It's absolutely amazing. Dr. Vallée, welcome to Skeptico. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
So let's talk for a minute about these books, because I know one of the goals you had and your publisher had, and I've spoken with your publisher, is to make these books more accessible. The other day I was on Amazon and I saw one of the original hardcover editions going for $300. So it's great that they're out there now and anyone can pick them up. And was that, in fact, one of your goals, is to kind of make these things more accessible for people?
Yes, and you know, I started writing this. It starts in 1957 when I was really a young student, hoping to learn science and to get into astronomy, which was my passion and to some extent still is. And I don't have a good memory, so I started writing things down so that I could track what I was learning, and very quickly got interested in UFOs because of a sighting I had made when I was a teenager, and it just kept accumulating new discoveries, new contacts, new people. And I thought, if I don't record all that just for my own interest, I'm not going to be able to really learn to see the patterns. And I wanted to apply science to all this, and that's how the diary started. Most of science is written by people at the end of their life, looking back on their glorious achievements, and it's a narrative, and of course it's very linear and so on. Science doesn't work that way. You try something, it doesn't work, so you try something else, and it kind of works, and then you contact somebody else who's ahead of you in the research, and you get together, and you form a team, and that's the way science works. And it cannot be disassociated from people's lives. I mean, look at, what we know about Einstein, what we know about Oppenheimer, what we know about the careers of these people. That's essential to understand relativity, or to understand radioactivity, to understand what people have done and what they went through. So you cannot dissociate the discoveries from the lives of people and those around them.
And I would suggest that the scope here is even broader. I mean, I was blown away. I kept thinking, somebody has to grab these journals, put them in a time capsule so that 100 years, 200 years, whatever, people can understand what our culture went through in struggling how to come to grips with these central, fundamental questions about who we are. I mean, yes, as a scientist, but more broadly, you've been right in the center of these just very, very deep fundamental questions, and I'm sure you've thought of that.
Well, and we need to learn from our mistakes and learn from, if there is disclosure, which or confirmation, whatever we call it this week, it's going to be like a tsunami, both in science. Of course, it's going to expose, all the things the government has done, the mistakes that scientists and skeptics have made. But it's also going to change a lot of things, and people are immediately going to rewrite history. And the original sources, that's what I'm trying to save. Of course, it's going to be swept under the waves, but eventually people are going to need access to that. You know, how did the ideas evolve? What were the real facts? Because it's not, there isn't going to be any clean discovery all of a sudden that, you know, the Martians are here and we're going to receive their ambassador at the White House or something. It's going to be very complicated, and it's going to impact religions, it's going to impact science at a fundamental level, and we are going to need access to archival material. So when I wrote those diaries, I never thought I would publish them, or maybe my kids would after I died. And then I thought, with what I saw around me, people just not knowing the background of some of the things that were happening, especially in France and in Europe and elsewhere, where I had been accumulating data. You know, a lot of American ufology is very self-centered. It's centered on Roswell, Washington, and a couple of big sightings that people keep talking about. Well, you know, the U.S., as big as it is, the U.S. is only 4% of the planet. There are things happening in the other 96%, and that's in part what I've been watching. So I thought I should publish that, but publish it in hardcover, so it's going to stay there, and it will be archived, and people, you know, the few people who are interested can have access to that. And then things sort of, you know, took off from there, because I saw that people were scanning those books, they were repurposing them, you know, replacing them again on the internet. And there was, in fact, a much larger interest in going back and looking at that. So that's when Anomalies suggested publishing them, you know, in paperback and in ebooks. I thought that was the right time to do it.
Great. And I'm really glad you did. And let's dive in. I mean, there's just so much to unpack here. Just at every turn, it's like, oh my gosh, this connection, that connection, way beyond just UFOs too, as people will see. But let's start. And I wanted to start at the very beginning. This reinforces some of the points you've just been making. But in the foreword, the very first page of the book, you write, "It is unusual for scientists to keep diaries, and even more unusual for them to make them public." And you just talked about all that. But then you come on to say, like most of my colleagues, I followed this rule of science for the last 30 years, never expecting that these journals would be published before my death. But I have finally decided that I had no right to keep them private anymore. Although they contain many passages that are very personal and some that are very painful, you're just wide open in these things. You kind of tell all. They also provide primary source about a crucial fact in the recent historical record. And this is what I wanted to highlight, obviously. The appearance of new classes of phenomena that highlighted the reality of the paranormal. Now, again, this is kind of your bread and butter, but to see it so starkly written by someone as prominent as you in no uncertain terms is still kind of stunning. And then if that's not enough, you go on to say, these phenomena were deliberately denied or distorted by those in authority within the government and the military. Science has never had a fair and complete access to the most important files. This fact has been alleged before, but never proven. The present book proves it. Again, everyone kind of says they know this, but until you see Jacques Vallée write this down, at least for me, it kind of had more of an impact. I have to start by asking, is that still your view in terms of those two major, major findings?
Well, more than ever. We keep finding, when people realize what has been going on, I think there will be at least a segment of the scientific community, the younger scientists, will cry that this was really a crime against, against knowledge, against everything. That there was some justification right after the war. There was a time of great turmoil and great uncertainty. The nuclear weapons had been deployed for the first time. There was a lot of suspicion in the world. You could understand that the files would have been kept secret. And, I don't have an issue with that, actually. I think government has a responsibility to keep certain things in confidence, if only to protect the witnesses and to protect the future. But, this is 70 years later. I mean, what do they have that today needs to be kept? So the information really needs to be open, maybe not all of a sudden, but it needs to be at the disposal of science. We've made enormous progress since then, both in terms of understanding the role of science in the world, in terms of deploying new industries, and also in terms of being able to do research on unusual things. And the acceptance of the idea of extraterrestrial intelligence, of course, is here. I mean, people don't deny now that there are thousands of planets out there. You know, when I was when I joined Dr. Hynek at Northwestern in 1963, we were teaching that there were planets throughout the universe. You know, that it was likely that there would be planets, including some planets that would be somewhat similar to the Earth and could support life around certain classes of stars. We were teaching that, but we couldn't prove it. It was just statistically, something that could be deduced from the observations. But now, the astronomers actually see them, and they have catalogs of thousands of these planets. So things have changed. The public is much more open to that. It's not a marginal, footnote anymore. It's really something that people can deal with psychologically. The public can deal with it.
But let me push on that for a minute, because, yeah, the public can deal with it. The public is way ahead of science. And you seem to be suggesting that access to the data is what's holding science back from the paranormal. And I got to tell you, I mean, that's wonderfully optimistic. I'm just not sure that's true. It certainly hasn't been my experience in interviewing some of the world's leading scientists about consciousness, about frontier consciousness science. I mean, they're willfully ignorant in a lot of cases, aren't they?
Yes, and the UFO problem, even among the people who accept the reality of the phenomenon, is still viewed as spacecraft. Spacecraft, like sort of like ours. People talk about let's look at the propulsion, let's look at the what kind of fuel they leave behind, let's look at which is fine, but they ignore most of what the witnesses are desperately trying to tell them, which is that this is also a parapsychological phenomenon, that it impacts their consciousness.
Well, how could they not ignore that? Because they ignore what parapsychologists tell us. They ignore what near-death experience researchers tell us. They ignore what researchers into the psychedelic experience tell us. They ignore all that because they're stuck in a very narrow mind equals brain materialistic paradigm. And you just blew that away with the foreword to your book, is I guess what I'm getting at. And that's, to me, the biggest paradigm shift. UFOs, alien contact, is a hop, skip, and a jump from accepting that the materialistic paradigm is falsified.
Well, that wouldn't be the first time in science. And, to be fair, when I talk to people in parapsychology, they don't want to hear about UFOs. I mean, right. they say, look, we've got enough trouble with, looking at ghosts and Uri Geller. Don't tell us about little things that come from the sky or things that, happen in somebody's bedroom interfering with the cat, you know. That's not... So you have to have a solid sense of humor. And I was privileged to work with people like Aimé Michel in France and like Dr. Hynek, of course, in the U.S., who had a sense of humor, the sense in perspective. If you don't have that in science, it's difficult to make progress. But that wouldn't be the first time that science would move sideways. Look how long it took to accept the idea of continental drift. That was pretty obvious when you look at a map of the world that continents have been drifting away from each other. But you couldn't call it that. You had to call it something else. And look at some of the discoveries in astrophysics that were made by geologists. And the geologists, don't go to the same congresses as astronomers, so they don't belong in the same discussion. And it's just fascinating. So among other things, the UFO problem is a gold mine for somebody who wants to look at the history of ideas. I mean, you don't have to take a position for or against UFOs. You just look at the record. I've been, the last few days, I've been looking over, going through my collections of the letters I've exchanged and the documents, my correspondence with Dr. Hynek, because there is a university that approached me and they are interested in preserving that material and working with it. And so I've been doing an index of all the letters we exchanged. And it would be a fascinating record for people who are getting into the field now. For example, I have a friend who said, what we need, and he's well-connected in Washington, and he says what we need is new congressional hearings about UFOs. Well, if you look at my correspondence with Hynek, we went through three different waves of ideas about congressional hearings. And there were congressional hearings before. Maybe we should look at that record before we do another one, because the results were not what people expected. And it doesn't do any good to knock on the door of Congress and say, look what we've got. You have to prepare, you have to do a lot of preliminary work if you're going to go anywhere with with Congress or with any part of the administration, for good reasons. It just doesn't work that way. And I think that we keep remaking the same mistakes, and maybe that's one value of my diaries, is that next time let's be a little bit more clever.
Yes. Perhaps. I think another obvious contribution that the diaries make that you alluded to kind of in what you were saying is looking at this stuff more broadly is just a gold mine. And you mentioned parapsychology. We've investigated parapsychology a lot on this show. As a matter of fact, my interest in UFOs really grew out of my interest in frontier consciousness science. And it's funny that, you kind of came the other direction, but not really. You were in the middle of this stuff from the beginning. I'd refer people to your diaries. I'm pretty sure it's in volume number 2, December 9th, 1972. You're having lunch with the very famous psychic, Uri Geller, who you just mentioned a minute ago. And let's set the stage. Prior to this, you've been talking to Dr. Russell Targ, Dr. Hal Puthoff, part of this group at Stanford Research Institute, that later goes on to get quite a bit of fame and attention about the Stargate Project. But at this point, they're looking at really crazy parapsychology things. And they got this. And we should add that they're doing that at the behest of the United States military, who is worried that the Russians are ahead of us in the psychic war thing. And that's their original interest in it. So anyways, here you are with Uri Geller, you've known about their interest in investigating him right from the beginning, and you tell, this is to these diaries, folks. I mean, the story you tell in here is just stunning. If you would, tell folks the story, your experience with Uri Geller here, the picture telepathy, the colors, the spoon bending, the whole thing.
Well, let me just cut to the chase. If I were a scientist getting into the field now, reading those books, reading those reports, that, you know, especially the books by Dr. Halputov and his colleagues, you would say, well, you know, there may be something there, but maybe there's something missing. Maybe not everything was recorded. You know, how do I know that this really happened? Because, it looks so fantastic. And these were good people. There is good science, you know, good analysis, good statistics. But, you know, it may not be enough to convince me. And what convinced me wasn't that. What convinced me was one time, of course, I had, you know, a number of discussions. Thanks to Halputov, I had access to people in that project because they had seen UFOs. And, of course, that was something that was important in the project, if only as a footnote. So they brought me in to help deal with that aspect of it. But there was one time when they had been doing some experiments, and this was Russell Targ, Halputov, a couple of other people, and Uri Geller. And the experiments had to do with Geller essentially drawing what was inside a sealed envelope, which were essentially targets, drawings of certain scenes, to see if he could reproduce them without opening the envelope. And they had a number of envelopes that they had not used that morning that they had with them. And we were sort of discussing, we were at the SRI cafeteria, you know, having lunch. And a big round table, and Geller was across the table from me. And Geller suddenly says, I want to do an experiment with you, Jacques. So I'm going to send you some numbers, or you send me some numbers. And so I said, how do you do that? And he said, well, look at you. You have a television set in your mind, and you put the number or the scene, and then you scan it as if you were looking at the TV. And I'll do the same thing. Very simple. In my mind, I'll open up a TV set and I'll just read what you're scanning. And we did that, and it worked, and it was kind of fun and so on. And then somebody said, it may have been Russell, let's do that with some of the targets we haven't used this morning. And he, how did that? He opened one of the envelopes and he gave it to me. And under the table, I looked at the scene that was there. And I was supposed to, again, put it on a TV set and send it to Uri. Well, the scene was pretty complicated because it was a whale spouting. So you had the waves, you had the whale, and then you had the water jet on top of the whale. And so I did my best to send that. And Uri said, well, what you're sending me is confusing. I'm not getting anything clear. Can you resend it? And behind him, through the window of the cafeteria, I could see a water jet, you know, in the courtyard. There was a fountain in the courtyard of SRI. And so I thought, I'm going to send it in two things. I'm going to send the whale, which is essentially a fish. I know a whale isn't a fish, but, you know, I'm going to send a fish, and I'm going to send the water jet that I see through the window. So I scanned the fountain, and then I scanned the fish, you know, like a Christian fish, very simple, you know, form of a fish. And Geller said, all of a sudden, he was all business. He took his pencil, and he drew something, and he says, look, I'm going to draw what I'm getting, but I'm not getting one thing, I'm getting two things. I'm getting a fish, and then I'm getting a water jet. So he drew the two things. So to me, that was the thing that remained, you know, as a proof, because he didn't draw the target. He drew what I sent him.
Right.
And he had no way of knowing. I mean, you know, a good prestidigitator might have looked at the targets ahead of time through the paper of the envelopes without opening the envelope. You know, Houdini used to do that. He used to do that trick where he read the target through the envelope. But there was no way he could have known that I did not send him the target. I sent him two things that I made up. And that's what he got. So to me, that was the proof of what Urie could do.
And then he ups the ante and he says, you know, Jacques, the physical is really what it's about. And he tell about the spoon bending story, because I think that does take it, when we take it beyond the mental, it goes into a different place for people.
Yeah, he said, you know, that's not really what I do. What I do is I deal with physical objects. And he touched his spoon, and the spoon folded in essentially in three, not in two.
And this is at a restaurant. This isn't like a prepared spoon that he has or anything like that.
Well, no, we had been eating ice cream, you know, and you can't eat ice cream with a spoon that's bent all the way back. So, no, this was, and we all reacted to that, and we all had the same spoon. And I tried to bend it, you know, the same way his spoon. The spoon wasn't just bent, it was just completely distorted, you know, as if it had been, as if a bulldozer had run over it. It was, no, I could bend the part of the spoon that's the thinnest, you know, just before the cup. I could sort of bend that, but the cup was bent, and then everything else was twisted around, and there was no way I could have done that. So there you are. But to me, the convincing thing was the part of the about the whale.
Yes,
because it showed that there was, that we can in fact communicate mind to mind. And by the way, you know, there is a book out called Phenomena about the whole, you know, the whole history of SRI and so on, and it relates to, it talks about the Nazi, it talks about all kinds of things about Puharich, and it's not completely wrong, but a lot of those experiments really didn't come from any of that. A lot of that tradition came actually from an organization that still exists in France and was working with people in England and so on. And there was a man named Varcolier, Varcollier, who did those experiments in the early 20th century. Mostly in France, and he's published all that. And the Ingo Swann and Puthoff and so on were very familiar with that work, and that's where a lot of the early experiments at SRI came from. They didn't come from Puharich, and they certainly didn't come from the, you know, from Hitler and the Germans and all that stuff. So I think that record should be corrected.
Very
but
good.
That's where a diary is a good record, because you can go back to the archival material, and you can see what actually happened, and because it's written down day by day, you know. I had a historian once who came to see me, and he wanted to interview me about the mouse, the invention of the mouse, you know, which you have now, you know, with your computer. You know, where did that come from? And I said, well, you know, there are a lot of people who were there at the time and could tell you about what happened. And he said, yeah, I can interview them, but you wrote about it at the time. And that's why, as a historian, that's the record I want. And because I was at SRI in the project that had invented the mouse. I had nothing to do with it. I mean, they had invented it, you know, many years before. And but people still believe that Apple invented the mouse, or maybe Xerox.
Yeah, Xerox.
And the mouse was invented a long time before.
Well, you're right in saying that that's what comes through in the diaries and in the loose form that they are. But Let me switch gears only slightly. I think it leads right back to that in a way, because for folks who are familiar with your work, one of the biggest contributions you've made to the UFO field is pushing the field to look beyond the flying saucer thing, which you just mentioned a minute ago. And you were the first to suggest, look for the UFO extended consciousness link, and you pointed folks towards all the possible connections between UFOs and the paranormal and strangeness in all sorts of different ways. And that has certainly become very much the paradigm that's in vogue. But I sometimes have to wonder if some people are taking that too far. I mean, we do still have some very good, reliable reports of flying saucers that are observed by people on the ground, in the air. We see them on radar. We see physical traces of them. We talk to people like Uri Geller, who you just mentioned, and he says something stunning that's right there in your diary. He says, Jacques, I don't have any power of my own. I get it all from the saucers. Or then you go over to the remote viewing group that we're talking about, Ingo Swann and the rest, and they are viewing alien spacecraft on another planet through, you know, another means of this extended consciousness realm called remote viewing. So I'm totally open to the UFO consciousness link, but I have to wonder if it really is this either-or situation the way that it's sometimes portrayed. And I'd love to hear your thoughts in general about all that.
Well, one of the characteristics of science is that in order to move forward, it has compartmentalized different fields. And even now, you know, in a big university, you have biologists and they don't talk to doctors, and doctors don't talk to the pharmacy people, and the pharmacy people don't talk to the computer people, and the computer people don't talk to the chemists. And a big part of modern science has to do with, you know, translational science, where you build bridges across those disciplines. And of course, the, you know, consciousness has always been the province of psychologists. You know, psychologists have done most of the work in parapsychology. And Skinner and other people, and of course Carl Jung and so on, were psychiatrists, they were MDs, or they were psychologists. In the meantime, you know, the physicists were saying, you know, what I study in my lab is matter, atoms and molecules and fields and things like that. Don't bother me with your dreams, you know, or your nightmares and so on. That's irrelevant to my work, you know. Give me something I can measure, I can weigh. You know. And the problem is that increasingly we're running into phenomena that don't agree, you know, to be put into little boxes like that. They, including human beings. I mean, human beings, we have, a mass and a physical reality, and you know, I think I'm physical. You know, when I certainly when I hit my head, you know, it hurts and it's there. But at the same time, we cannot continue to ignore consciousness, because consciousness shows up in quantum mechanics. It shows up in entanglement. It shows up in all kinds of things that physics has been, you know, worried with in the last 10 years, in the last 5 years. And all that isn't part of official physics yet, in terms of being taught everywhere. But that's clearly where the next breakthroughs in physics are going to be. So in a way, studying these phenomena, both parapsychology and the UFO phenomenon, is just a glorious way into what physics is going to be for the next 50 years.
Well, maybe. I guess I have my reservations, because physics has known about this for the last 50 years. And back to the willful ignorance, I mean, physics has known the observer effect, for example. They've known entanglement. They've done the shut up and calculate thing for the last 50 years, which is okay. Shut up and calculate works for creating awesome networks and iPhones and computers and all that stuff, but it doesn't answer the deeper philosophical questions. And I think also what you're suggesting, and I would agree with, is that science has, to a certain extent, obsoleted itself. It said, okay, there really are these limits to what we can measure, what we can observe, what we can call reality. So getting back to your work, though, what I worry about is that when I hear people use your work as a manifesto against little gray men in spaceships from other planets, because I don't know how you get around that data. I don't know how you get around that data cross-culturally. You know, you go talk to a Native American, Artie Six Killer Clark, like I did on this show, who's interviewed PhD, Dr. Artie Six Killer Clark, who has interviewed, you know, 2,000 Native Americans, both in North America and South America, and they all say, yeah, they're star people from another planet. Those reports are over and over again in, you know, sociology, if you just go look, and anthropology, if you just go look. So is it really an either-or thing? Is it really we can't have the spaceships and the little gray men and the extended consciousness strangeness, or are they perhaps somehow both on the table, both happening in ways that we haven't quite pulled apart yet?
Well, they are both, and that's what I've been arguing, that you have to get out of these little boxes, you know, physics on my left and psychology on my right. You can't do that. But you cannot do that in dealing with UFOs. But what I'm saying is that you cannot do that anymore in dealing with astrophysics.
Right.
Physics. I mean, the problem that scientists have today is that time and space, the way we were thinking about them, don't make sense when you begin to deal with particle entanglement and with entanglement of larger physical things. So we're going to get to the same place eventually. And what I've been doing quietly the last couple of years is looking at things left behind after UFO encounters, after close encounters. And I'm talking about things that were either found, you know, after a UFO had landed, or in addition to the hard traces and so on, and things that were ejected from UFOs in flight. There are a number of cases that where the witnesses are describing a disc that seems to be shaking, seems to be about to explode, and he gets stabilized by other objects that come around it, and then it ejects some material infusion. There's a celebrated case like that at Council Bluffs in the suburb of Omaha, where people were able to pick up the material immediately, and the police was there, and there were 11 witnesses and so on. So I've recovered a number of those artifacts, and there were two problems with that have sort of plagued the research for a long time. First, it's difficult to get access to that because either people throw it away, so you know something happened, but you know they didn't keep it because some scientist told them, oh, it's just an ordinary stone, so they threw it away. Or they keep it as a family heirloom, and they won't let you borrow it. There's a case I've been talking to people at MUFON about an artifact that they have, but, you know, I cannot, they won't let me analyze even a little part of it because, oh, you know, that's so, you know, precious and so on. Well, you know, it's about time that science looked at this. Fortunately, I'm just getting three of these cases analyzed from France where people are sending me the actual sample, the actual specimen, Most of that is metal. And the other thing that was very difficult was that beyond chemical analysis, it was very hard to get access to a machine where we could look at the isotopes. And now those machines are, at least I have access to at least two different machines right here in Silicon Valley, because I'm pretty well connected with the, you know, the high tech community, including one company that I financed as a venture capitalist. So I have access to their engineers, and these are not only do they have a machine, but they've built the machine. So I have access to the people who have actually engineered the instrument, and we can begin to look at this. And what we're finding is very preliminary, but it's absolutely fascinating, because we're not finding what we thought we would find. You know, we would find either that the materials were terrestrial, and by the way, when you look at the isotopes, it doesn't lie, because it's you can look at the ratios of the actual different types of aluminum, for example, or magnesium that is in the sample. And you can look at the ratios of the abundance of different isotopes of the same metal, the same element. And so either it should be terrestrial, which we can find out very quickly, or it could be extraterrestrial, in which case you'd expect that it would vary by a few percent from the standard ratio. And, you know, most of those machines are mass spectrometers, and they are used by often used by geologists, among other people, who look at meteorites. Meteorites are extraterrestrial, and they don't have the same ratio of isotopes that you do if you pick up, you know, a piece of iron on Earth. So they are used to looking at ratios that are a little bit different. But what we find is ratios that are 100% off. And that is completely new. And that is something that we're
going to be... Break that down a little bit. I think everyone will follow that terrestrial objects have a certain ratio correlation between the isotopes. Extraterrestrial meteors have a different set of ratios that are slightly off. And then you run across this material, and what is it telling you?
So in a number of cases, including a celebrated case at Ubatuba in Brazil and a couple of other cases, we're beginning to find material that is completely off the natural ratios. And this does not mean that it comes from, you know, a star somewhere in our galaxy, because the galaxy was formed from essentially the same material condensing, the same material from, you know, from stars of a particular generation condensing into the metals and the elements that we have around us today. So, yeah, there is a variation between the way the Earth was formed and the way, say, Pluto was formed. So you'd expect the meteorites, for example, to be somewhat different. And, of course, those differences are very interesting. But that's not what we find. What we find is that, first, some of the isotopes are missing. The isotopes are on completely different ratios. Some of them are double the percentage that they should be. And what that could indicate is that somebody has taken that material, separated the isotopes, and then re-engineered the material. So if we can confirm that, and again, this is very preliminary, and you can't just do that by running it in one machine. You have to find... So I presented that material in France a couple of months ago, because I want to get access to labs in France. This should be done completely away from the intelligence people, from the military people. It should be done in the academic labs, completely open. And the witnesses should be invited to the lab to prove that we're not, you know, substituting some strange thing, that this is actually their material. And, you know, there is no reason not to do that openly and to return the material to them. We don't need to keep it. The especially for things that come from 1947. In 1947, the only people who could separate the isotopes were the atomic people, separating uranium-235 from uranium-238, you know, which is what Iran is doing now with their centrifuge and, you know, the whole business about the atom bomb in Iran and so on. You separate the isotopes and then you build something new because of new physical properties. Why would you go around doing that for magnesium or for iron or for things of that type? And that's what we find. It's as if somebody had separated those isotopes and then recombined them to build the material that we find. So if we can confirm that, and again, the qualifier is we're really at the very beginning of that, but, you know, this is material. I mean, this is material science. This is not parapsychology. This is not, you know, somebody dreaming. This is not, you know, something from hypnotic regression of an abductee or something.
Not to put any of that stuff down, right? I mean, just to make clear the difference.
I did it as a PowerPoint presentation that I've given in a couple of places, trying to get scientists interested in looking at that material with us, because we need help. I mean, and there are experts in that stuff, and the question is, how much would it cost to do something like that? And it looks like, you know, this would be billions of dollars if we did it with today's technology. But maybe somebody has a different way of doing it. And so this is at the heart of... There are three things that you get, if you want to talk about the physics. There are three things that we get, or that people claim. The implants... And I've stayed away from that because I'm not a biologist. This is not my field, but I followed it. It's very interesting. And of course, we can get those implants and we can study it. Dr. Lear started doing that, and, you know, other people have become involved. And it's very complex. And then there are claims that, of course, entire craft have been recovered at Roswell or at other places and are being kept in somebody's basement. And, yeah, I've become convinced that some of that is true. I've had people coming to me, usually in the dead of the night, saying, you know, I was approached to study that, and, yes, it's true, and we couldn't figure out what that was. One of these people I can talk about, because he's dead, was Marcel Vogel, who was an IBM special fellow. Marcel Vogel is responsible for building for billions of dollars of revenue to IBM in the days of magnetic data, you know, magnetic deposition on tapes and disks. And he was approached by the government to look at parts of something that had crashed. So we know these people exist. We know the stuff exists, but I don't have access to it. I mean, the government doesn't invite me to go into that basement. But eventually that stuff has got to come out. But what I do have is people coming to me and saying, look, you know, I saw this in a field last night in France somewhere, and, you know, it ejected this material, and here it is. And you can have it. You can take it to a lab and tell me what you find. So that stuff, you know, I can do on my own. I don't need anybody's permission. So that's what I'm going to continue doing.
Interesting. And, you know, Dr. Ville, you mentioned a couple times in there the government, you mentioned the military. The term deep state doesn't appear anywhere in your journals because that's just a newly coined phrase. But the idea of a force that's lurking in the shadows kind of shows up again and again and again. I'd go all the way back as we wind this thing down to the foreword of the very first volume. There's only one sentence that's bolded, and the sentence reads, "The major revelation of these diaries may be the demonstration of how the scientific community was misled by the government, how the best data were kept hidden, and how the public record was shamelessly manipulated. So I want to know, do you think, you seem very optimistic, and I love the idea of what you just outlined there is fantastic in terms of the potential research. Can we really talk about any of it without talking about the deep state overlay and what they're doing? Or can we just say, don't worry about it, just go do our own thing?
Well, two things that may surprise you. One is some of that, if we knew, might be legitimate, or it might have been legitimate at one time. So I'm not going to, bang on the door of the Pentagon saying, shame on you, and so on. I want to understand deeply, what has been going on. And that's, that's something that we have to sort of keep working on. I think eventually the information will come out because the phenomenon is global and it cannot be controlled. So I'm looking at this with the reason I'm still optimistic. It's my nature. I'm an optimist, and I also try to keep my sense of humor. The phenomenon is in control, and whatever it is. And there is no way you can classify something that happens in the pasture in the south of France or in Ireland somewhere. And if these people pick up some material and they want to bring it to me, I don't know who can.
Right.
So I really believe that we're going to have enough things to work on. What irritates me about the UFO, believers, the UFO community, is that a lot of people sit in their chair arguing about what should be done and what the government should do. In the meantime, there is a lot of stuff out there that we have access to that nobody's looking at. And there are a lot of things that we could do and that we could have done that is urgent, that nobody's going to stop you from building a database, looking at statistics, getting in your car and going out and talking to those witnesses and finding out what's true and what's not true. And, still 90% of those reports we can explain. So let's not forget that. We see those beautiful statistics about thousands of cases a month, but only a few of those are really valid. Well, somebody needs to go out there and find out. So there are a lot of all those things we can do, and we don't need to ask government permission to do it. Silicon Valley doesn't ask the government permission to go build something. To a large extent, the internet was built by people just linking their computer to the net and going out and doing something new. Nobody asked for permission to develop the World Wide Web. Some kid in Switzerland did that, without asking anybody's permission. He just coded it and released it.
Let's talk about that for a minute, because the other thing that shines through in these diaries, and more broadly just in your career for anyone who looks at it, is you're very practical, and you're also have figured out the money thing, if you will, in a way that a lot of scientists don't. You're super successful as a computer scientist, could have made a fantastic career just with that. Very successful as an author, could have made a fantastic career as that. As a matter of fact, you won writing prizes before you even got into any of this stuff. But you became really successful as an entrepreneur and a venture capitalist. Tell us what that means. I mean, a lot of people stumble into Silicon Valley and don't wind up figuring out how to operate in the game at this different level that you did. What do you think that says about you, and what do you think it says about other people in this field and where they might grow in terms of the practical figuring out the world kind of stuff?
Well, one thing about Silicon Valley is that you cannot hide anywhere because people know what you've done. They know your mistakes. And your mistakes are very important, by the way. They know, you know, the good stuff you've done. And, you know, they're in venture capital, success is measured in dollars. So there are a lot of people who've made more money than I have in Silicon Valley, and more power to them. I had the luck or the privilege of being an engineer and a computer scientist before I was an entrepreneur, and then being an entrepreneur before I was an investor. So I sat on those sides of the table before I sat on the side of the table where I am now. So I know what it takes, and I know the things that you don't learn in business school, like, you know, what do you do when you wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning, sweating and knowing you cannot make payroll tomorrow? Okay, and there are things you can do when, but they don't teach that. And I've been there, and that's why I can be helpful to, you know, a young company.
Why don't more scientists figure that out? Because there's something that brings more broadly to scientific inquiry, especially when the scientific inquiry demands that we step outside of the box like you have so many times. I mean, I see the parallels. Do you? I mean,
yes, but I think the secret is that when you're an entrepreneur or a scientist, you know, inventing something, or you have to be, you know, what people call interrupt driven. I mean, if a phone call comes in, there's an opportunity, there is a new thing, you jump on it, you make decisions, you change the plan, you get more money, you reallocate your resources, your priorities, and so on. So that's, there are people who have that kind of mind. And those are the people, those are the great entrepreneurs, great CEOs, and so on. Then, and as an entrepreneur, you learn that, or you get out. Okay, and I did learn some of that. But then, as an investor, you have to look all the time. You have to look at the long range. You know, when you invest in something, it's not like buying a stock that you can sell tomorrow. I mean, a venture capitalist is buying stock that has essentially its paper with no value whatsoever. And now we're going to work very, very hard for 2, 5, 7, 10 years, maybe more, with a team of people that we're intimately, you know, linked to, sort of guiding them, providing resources they need, so that piece of paper is going to be worth something someday. I mean, look at the history of Apple, you know. And it's very hard, it's very rare to find people who have both types of mind, who can both react very quickly to an interrupt, to a crisis, to something, and keep their eye on the long term, because that's what you have to do if you're going to be a good investor, or at least a good venture capitalist, which is different from, you know, being an investor in the stock market. So I've had very good mentors in that field. People I've worked with for a long, long time. And, you know, I've learned some stuff from them, and I try to apply that to UFOs. So I don't react to every time somebody sees something, or every time the Air Force or the government makes a claim. I keep looking at the long term. In the meantime, I look at, you know, what little resources I have, and what I can do at my own level, and that's what I continue to do. And I'm not going to, you know, expect that somebody is going to give me, a grant for a 10-year research project, because that's not going to happen. I mean, if it happens, fine, but, you know, in the meantime, I'm not going to wait for that. I'm going to do my stuff at my level and try to help other people who are doing research, if I can have something of benefit to them. And as I get older, I want to do more of that. In other words, spending more time helping other people in the field get over those obstacles and continuing the archival work.
Once again, our guest has been Dr. Jacques Vallée. The books you're going to want to check out, buy, put in the attic for your kids, put in a deep data vault, are Forbidden Science, Volume 1, 2, and 3. It's been terrific having you on, and I thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Thanks again to Dr. Jacques Vallée for joining me today on Skeptico. One question I guess I tee up from this interview. What do you make of the ordinary way that he talks about such extraordinary events and particularly extraordinary science? And does this reveal that there's some deeper knowledge about things that most of us just don't know about? You can probably guess my answer to that question, but I want to hear yours, and I'd love to do so. Go to the Skeptico website, find the Skeptico forum, join, leave me an answer, leave me an idea, share your ideas with other people, connect with me on Facebook, or just send me an email. While you're there, of course, be sure to check out the over 350 previous episodes of Skeptico. All there, all available for free for download. Please take advantage of it. Love when people find the show and then find all the old episodes and enjoy going back through that journey with me. So if that's you, do it. And if you feel inclined to send me an email when you're doing it, that's great too. I have a number of great shows coming up. They're going to come out every week for a while because I've just been overzealous. Interviewing has got the best of me, and I have a little bit of a backlog. So stay with me for all of that. Until next time, take care, and bye for now.